This is Devin.
And this is Elmer.
Welcome to the Forum Journey Podcast. Hey guys, welcome to the Forum Journey Podcast. We are here with Cole. Cole, what would you say you're most excited about with what that's going on today? Is there, I mean, maybe there's many, but
oh my goodness, yeah. There's so much stuff that's going on that's been overwhelming. I don't know. I you guys shared that question with me, and I've been pondering how I would respond. Can I like tell you some of the new stuff that's not so new necessarily?
You can do whatever you want, Cole.
All right. So let's see. I mean, the pandemic makes things super challenging.
Yeah.
But in any struggle that we face, there's innovation that happens. I mean, if we're willing to like be creative about it, you know, I watch businesses in our community get creative about how they're going to respond to the pandemic. And I've been so impressed with the way some like restaurateurs, as much negative press as certain restaurants have gotten, and or maybe positive, I don't know, matters what side of that discussion you're on. But there's other businesses, there's other restaurants that have just become innovative in how they are going to serve people food in the midst of trying to be respectful about social distancing and stuff like that, right? And it's been amazing. And of course, so many other industries and businesses and ministry that is that way as well. Like, so our food bank, we in the past usually have served about, I don't know, 2 or so tons of grocery food a month. And now just in during the pandemic, we've done over 2 million pounds of food. And delivering it in a food box delivery program. Yeah. And some of that is going to end up sticking. We found better ways to serve people in outlying areas by bringing them food boxes rather than asking them to come to us. Because a lot of folks are just lacking transportation or it's a long way to go. And there really isn't an ability to gain access to food close enough by for them to tangibly go pick it up. And so right now, everything we do for food bank is, again, food box delivery. So we set up, this was like right after things closed down. Fortunately, we have good IT folks in our congregation, but where we built a new website, gatherstockbox.com, and people can just go on there and sign up for a food box. And you'll get one, you have to sign up every week, but you'll have one delivered to you. So we deliver like 700-ish food boxes every week and have for now just about a year, right out of a year. So it's been, and again, probably things will shift and change over the next 6 months when it comes to folks that live closer by, as it's safe to have people show up and pick up boxes. But again, we have established wonderful relationships with other organizations, other churches farther outlying area, East County and PL and the outreaches of Lewis County. We know how huge it is geographically that we're working with, and we pack the boxes and we bring the boxes to a central location, and we have 8 or 10 drivers that show up and pick up and scatter them all over the place. So I'm excited to see. I mean, part of me is like, you know, constantly praying, asking God, where do we, you know, what does this look like in 3 months and 6 months and 9 months? And I don't have all those answers.
Does he tell you?
No.
Okay. Just like, checking, because I just like, wanted to know if he answers you.
Like, here's the bullet points. Yeah.
Right. This feels like, I don't know, you ask and you find leading that you only see in retrospect. Like, oh, I saw what you were doing there. Right. It's like, so that's really exciting. So we've also, some of the other just wonderful things that have come our way is development of more services around housing and homelessness, which is also quite concerning in light of the pandemic. You know, right now there's a moratorium on evictions, but there's a lot of folks that are way behind. We were able to help distribute through a CARES Act about $75,000 in October, November for people behind in rent, just in the city of Centralia, in utilities. And that was just scratching the surface. Yeah. There are going to be a lot of folks that are going to be living in their cars. And there's going to be homeowners that rent that are potentially going to lose their properties because they're behind in mortgage because of people being behind in rent. And it's so there's given that future, and who knows? I mean, maybe we as communities rally together and figure out how to make and bridge these gaps. But I don't, you know, you can't wait around to hope that everything works out just fine.
Sure,
rather,
sure.
You have to make plans. So we've developed a lot of additional housing homeless services. We are now a coordinated entry agency for a county. And so anybody that's on the verge of becoming homeless, so at imminent risk of homelessness, or that is literally homeless, living on the streets or in their car or night by night in a hotel, we can help connect them with and vet them for different housing programs.
Yeah.
And so it's hard work. It's really, really hard work for numerous reasons. But I'm excited to be in the position of doing that in light of where things are, you know, with pandemic and with moratorium being lifted at some point. And then again, there's just bigger systemic issues that we face in our community just with housing. We have a massive lack.
Before the pandemic, I mean, just in our community, there isn't a lot out there as far as open places to rent or even.
Yeah, there's a less than 1% vacancy rate.
Yeah.
Like it's considered, you know, extremely difficult market to rent anytime it dips below 7%, and it's less than 1%.
Yeah.
Like we work with people on a daily basis living in their cars that aren't necessarily what somebody would, you know, stereotype as homeless. Not that, and I hate saying that, because I even for the stereotypical homeless or underhoused or those struggling to find housing, we still need to love, care for, see God's image in them.
Yeah.
Right. It's not since it doesn't look as bad as some people think it looked, then we should do something. We should do something matter what.
I've always said, anyone who's listening to any of our lives, it's only a divorce.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lost job.
Yeah.
It's maybe a loss of a child, of a death. Mm-hmm. And that sends you spiraling.
Medical accident.
It's not much that puts us from where we're at today to being in our car.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, and we have stories of people who it's a flat tire that they don't have a way to fix.
Right.
They lose their job because they can't make it to their job. And I mean, they call their work and they're like, I can't make it. I'm going to be late because I've got a flat tire and I don't have a good spare or whatever. And they're like, I'm sorry, but like, we have to move on to hire somebody else. You can't, it's like, you would think the world of employment wouldn't be so fickle, but it is, you know? So yeah, it's like we are, none of us are, if we want to be honest, are far from that. And
well, it goes to your point of we need each other.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, without a support system, there are times where I wouldn't have anyone else to turn to, but because I had people who were like a net that mm-hmm. I could fall back into and could help me figure out things that I didn't know what to do. I would be in a worse position or place.
There are pivotal moments in my life where I'd be I don't know where I would be if it
toast.
Wasn't for yeah
just
absolutely
toast.
Right yeah right. Dry toast, burnt probably. Burnt. Unless you like burnt toast, then it's be under toasted. Yeah, so those are exciting things. Let's see, one last thing I'll throw out is that we've also been growing our SUD or substance use disorder services, and so that's been pretty amazing. And I said that this would be the last thing, but there's one more thing I'll tack on to the end of it. And so let's see, going back almost a year now, we partnered with the ADAI department of the University of Washington and have opened a low barrier Suboxone program.
Yeah.
And so that's been absolutely phenomenal. It is, we've had right at 90 people that we've been able to connect with SUD treatment now in a year in our community. And I'll tell you, it's just barely scratching the surface of how many folks are struggling with opioid use disorder in specific. And I'll tell you, it's overwhelming how devastating it is to people's lives. We have folks that access treatment that have been, that were prescribed opiates 20 years ago, and they're now in their 70s, and they're now just starting to access treatment source resources.
Wow.
There's so much stigma attached to it, right? It's like people don't want to, you know, it's one thing if people can, if they have connection with a doctor who will keep prescribing, because there are plenty of
yes,
doctors that will keep prescribing ridiculous amounts of opiates. And so, so it's like if people are continuing to just take pills for 20 some years, there's some stigma, but there's not a lot, right? Because it's prescribed to me.
Mm-hmm.
When those run out for many, they turn to heroin because it's way too expensive to maintain a pill habit. And then things oftentimes spiral more and more downward for folks. But you know, some of the clients that we have that are maybe in that category of folks in their 70s, or sometimes I don't think we have had anybody that we've gotten into treatment that's older than in their 70s. But they've you know, it's usually when their doctor finally has their license pulled, and now they're left
without any way
to. And they're having to face now a really incredible opiate addiction, and don't know
a reality that they have been masking for a long time.
And they aren't, you know, struggling and living on the streets and don't know who they would go to get, you know, any illicit drugs off the street. And so here they are, like, they can't get pills. They're losing their minds, and they don't know what to do. And so those are, particularly with our Suboxone clinic, the folks that we're targeting is just people that are the regular healthcare system is either abuse them and they're not trusting of it, or they're just slipping through the cracks one way or another.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe they early transition from a pill to heroin, but they just need a next step. They just need some way to access the level of care that they need and move on from there. So, you know, it's really super challenging work. We've got a team of three nurses, quite a few doctors that are involved, but one primary doctor that oversees the whole of the physician side of things, and then care navigators that are kind of the first person you would meet, lived experience folks that have been there and done that, that you would feel comfortable with. As somebody coming in off the streets to connect with, that would bring you through the journey of getting you connected with a nurse, getting you into a electronic health program record,
mm-hmm.
and working it from there, and then walks with you to connect you with other resources and services and stuff too. So,
this is huge. I mean, to have someone walk with you through that and to see, like, there's light at the end of the tunnel here. This is, I'm not just on my own.
Oh yeah.
I don't have to.
Somebody that, like the way that one of our care navigators, her name is Brooke, and I've known Brooke. She was running the streets of Centralia
mm-hmm.
6 years ago when I first met her, and she has no idea what an incredible light she is to the community. But I mean, she's like, wants other people to know that, like, you might think you can't do this, but you can.
Yeah.
'Cause she was the person who would never have thought she could do it,
right?
And it took her, you know, years of, you know, there's many different places and ways that she could have heard this, but in her situation, it was years of coming to the cafe to have people that would care about her no matter what,
mm-hmm.
and stumble, fumble, bumble, having a hard time, disappearing for weeks, months, showing back up, and you're still cared about, you're still loved, you still belong. You haven't diminished your value, struggling with whatever, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I could tell the same story of Chad. You know, oh my goodness, I should tell you his story really fast. He's giving me permission. I've told the story a lot, but anyway, in a nutshell, you know, he was guy struggling with addiction, and came around our cafe quite a bit. And I just remember there was this pivotal moment one day when he gets into a fight with his girlfriend. This is long ways back. I don't know. This is 8 years, nine years ago. And he's in a fight with somebody out on the outside in the street, right across from our old cafe building. And they break up and he throws all of her stuff outside, and I watch this happen, right? And I'm walking out and trying to make sure the fight doesn't go too far, right? Yeah. And so he tears off. She picks up some stuff, leaves the rest of the garbage laying out there, and I proceed to go get a garbage bag, and I'm picking it up, and I'm like, doggone it. I'm frustrated. I got to pick up after other people's garbage I've thrown around. And I just remember my prayer at the time was, Lord, let this like time of me picking up after Chad and come to something, right? And then I don't see Chad now next after that for like 6 months. And I'm like, that hurt my feelings anyway. It kind of did. I was worried about him. But then it turns out he was arrested not long after that, incarcerated. And so I didn't know what all was going on with him. And I did discover that maybe a month after this event that he was in jail. And so he gets out, and the first place he comes is back down to the cafe. It's like his mom picked him up and just dropped him off there. Mm-hmm. And he was and from that moment, like, that was just this changed Chad, just different guy. I mean, he's still rough around the edges. He's a handful sometimes. I mean, he's an amazing counselor.
I don't know him as being rough around the edges. I appreciate his love.
Yeah. He's got a way in with folks that are where he was. Mm-hmm. That is powerful, and it's pretty amazing to see a guy go from, you know, a guy throwing garbage out in the street, mm-hmm. to making a huge difference in the lives of other folks that are struggling with substance use disorder in our community. And there's many others. There've been quite a few guys that have gone through a program that have gotten their SUDPs or substance, their
counselors.
I throw out all these acronyms.
No, you're fine.
Substance use professional. So
one of my sayings is, you either stay clean, you go to jail, or you die.
Yeah.
And that staying clean is so hard.
Yeah.
And I know for many, they don't have the support. Right. Not everybody has that. And so you, as a gatherer, as you become their family. That's mm-hmm. why the mom drops off Chad. It's like, hey, you go to your family. Because they're going to love you, because I'm sick and tired of loving on you. So,
yeah, and it takes that oftentimes. You know, I feel for a lot of families who are family members that they love very much, that they're trying to help in their own in their recovery, because it's family, and it's a different connection with family, because there hasn't been like years of knowing buttons to push to get dad to do what I want him to do, or mom to do what I want her to do, or mm-hmm. the manipulation piece it can still happen in the family of gather or whatever community it happens in, but it's different, right? It's like there's a different, so it's like it's family one step removed, where you can have a little better picture of maybe what somebody's up to and some of the games they might be playing, and a different way to come at them.
I call it the hammer. I mean, I need someone else to provide the hammer. They're making you do all this stuff, and I'm going, yes, thank you, Jesus.
But
it's easier to play, because then you can come alongside them and say, yeah, they're making you do this, but you see the transformation and the celebration is. Yeah. And in fact, I think those are things that we want to celebrate. Mm-hmm. The individuals like Chad and what was the young lady?
Brooke.
I wouldn't say Bonnie, but it's like, I know it's not Bonnie. The B name. But the Brooks of, and not just in our community, but they're all over. Yeah.
Absolutely.
They're all over. And again, that's part of that kingdom thing that's happening.
Yeah. Well, and it's like, it really just comes down to like this call to live as Jesus lived. You watch the transforming power of Jesus' love. And by love, I mean dedication, the seeing value in people, the like just the willingness to sacrifice for oneself, for somebody else.
Sure.
That, you know, isn't a matter of like, they deserve it. Like, I hate that deserve word, right? It's like,
we all deserve.
I know, right?
Right? I mean, it's like,
if you're going to put it that way, then it becomes something else, right? It's because of God's loving kindness, his dedication to us, his grace for us, his willingness to not give up on us despite our worst, you know? And so we see that in Jesus, and that's massively transforming. I mean, I know it's transforming for my life, and I'm sure it is for all of yours, that when like we want to belong, we want to know somebody's there for us. We want to feel the sense that like we're no matter what, like this person's for us. You know, it might be that they're a hammer, right?
Right.
One of my favorite things to be is a velvet hammer. I don't know, have you heard of this velvet hammer thing before? I used to have a professor that was very much a velvet hammer. Sven Soderlund is his name. And anyway, he was like, he was so funny. He's a Swedish guy. And he's like, if you ask him for something, for a favor in class, maybe an extension on an exam or something, he'd be like, oh, yeah, Derek Cole, you know, that's there. It's a really difficult situation you're facing there. I'm really sorry that, you know, you need that there extra time. I totally understand. That makes a lot of sense. But no. I mean, he was just like, you were sure the first time he was talking to you that he was going to go, he was going to give you exactly what you're asking for. And it's just like, so anyway.
My hope was rising, and then you shattered.
The velvet hammer slams down with a mighty thud or something. Anyway. Yeah, so it's like, you know, it takes that, right? It's like the sense of, like, with him even, there was, you still did know he understood and cared. He wasn't going to make an exception to this rule, but he heard you, right? It was better than just a blunt,
no,
I don't care about you or your situation or whatever. Like, he understood. He's like, but no, I'm still not going to make this exception. And so it's like figuring out how to have good boundaries and the boundaries that you're even upholding in ways that still let people know that this is because you care, not, and you might still get it wrong, but you care. It's not because you're just tired of them or frustrated or whatever. It's there's a real reason for a no. So
yeah, and it doesn't devalue the person,
right?
So one of the questions we wanted is what didn't you expect to happen but it did?
So I think a lot of our work around, if we're talking about, like, still all kinds of things that happened that I wouldn't expect to have happened, particularly around gather and ministry and stuff. So I would not have guessed that our participation with things like mobile harm reduction would, like, I think that would have surprised me if I would have gone back 5 years ago or longer.
What was that?
So mobile, like, harm reduction work. So actually helping to make sure that folks that are struggling, not yet ready to seek treatment, are able to, say, access things that will help them stay healthy and safe while they're still struggling with their substance use disorder. So I mean, so we go out on a weekly basis, and we're going to do it twice a week. I wanted to have this operational last month, but it'll be this month, into the community and help folks. Again, I don't necessarily want to get into all the nitty-gritty of it, but again, it's a matter of folks that are in active addiction, and you're trying to keep them from dying before they're willing to seek treatment.
Gotcha.
Lot of people think that if you only allow people who are making less than life-giving decisions to suffer more, they'll be compelled to healthier choices.
To change.
And it's the opposite of that, if there's such a thing as the opposite of that. I have to think about it a little bit. But that does not work. Like, allowing people to wallow in pain when part of the reason they are is they have such a low view of themselves that they don't want to be cognizant of themselves, to think that giving them a lower view of themselves is going to, or massive health problems is going to compel them to seek something different. It's crazy. You know, it doesn't work. It just, again, it doesn't work that way generally, right? I mean, you occasionally hear about people that are struggling with homelessness, say, or being underhoused, and you hear stories like, I just got sick and tired of laying my head in a mud puddle, and I decided to do something else. But even when that is the case, typically there's something and somebody that they knew that were able to assist them in finding a place to lay their head other than in a mud puddle at night.
Yeah, some
right?
next steps.
Yeah, and so it's not even so black and white when that is the case. There has to be some kind of option, some kind of opportunity that's known to somebody that it could be different. And that, and that's to strip out the levels of complexity for most people. So let's come back to somebody struggling with SUD. Most people that I've known over the years that are struggling with illicit drugs are like some of the kindest, gentlest, most lovely people that you ever want to know, and are devastatingly hurt. They've been victimized repeatedly in their lives, and they don't have any good options as far as how to even start to think about facing all of what they feel and have experienced right. prior to and during their active addiction. And so what transforms people to begin their journey of even imagining they could live in recovery is somebody giving a shit, you know, somebody right. caring about their lives that, you know, again, we harken back to Jesus. This is not like any new methodology of how people's lives are transformed.
We're talking Matthew 25.
We're talking like this should be the central understanding of what it means to be a disciple, is to live that way with people, right. inspire them to hope. So, coming back then to our harm reduction work, we are meeting people where they are. There's no strings attached to you have to enter into recovery. As a matter of fact, we know you're probably not doing that today. Not as a hopeless, but just as a reality or take on reality. And we are going to make sure that you stay healthy while you're in active addiction, as a means to connect you with us, as a means to, again, just keep you healthy, and as a means to hopefully seek you your involvement in recovery at some point in the future. Yeah. And so many, many, many of the folks of the 90-some that have gone through into the Suboxone program we've met in the harm reduction work.
Gotcha.
And cool. So it's bridging the gap, and it's, again, keeping people alive and healthy. You know, there's so many things that are positive about harm reduction, but it takes a different mindset. Like, you have to shift. That's why I wouldn't have seen it coming 5 years ago.
Gotcha.
Like, I wasn't quite there yet. I wasn't quite to the point where I saw that this was such an effective way to both keep communities healthy as a whole and keeping those who are still in active addiction healthy, compelling them then to other better choices in life. And so let's see, where was I going with that? Yeah, I didn't see that coming. So I was going to just give some examples. So like we give out fentanyl test strips. So, I mean, it's more, so what that is basically is that somebody, if they're active user of heroin, and nowadays people's heroin is oftentimes equal parts or more fentanyl.
Gotcha.
That some
okay.
dude, you know, mixed up in his basement right. after right. buying something on the black web, and some fentanyl got a hold of some, and now it's in the community, especially at a time during pandemic. All this stuff sounds crazy. Like, this is the kind of stuff that I would not have seen coming maybe more than 5 years ago, but somewhere around that time frame. There are people that are in active addiction. There are people that are really going to suffer, struggle, have a really hard time, and are not going to be compelled to recovery just because their availability of their illicit drug is not there for them. That situation meets pandemic. Mm-hmm. Heroin isn't coming. It sounds like a good thing, and in many ways it is, depending upon what kind of resource you have to catch people.
Yeah.
That stream is interrupted, and it doesn't mean that now there aren't illicit drugs. It means that somebody goes from selling heroin to finding fentanyl, selling it as heroin. And now, you know, like Walla Walla had, I believe it was 16 fentanyl deaths in one weekend, 3 weeks ago.
Wow.
And it's because, like, folks that are active heroin users are not getting what they think is heroin. Instead, they're getting fentanyl that somebody, you know, used ridiculously large portions and doesn't take much, right? I don't know if you've seen like a lethal dose of fentanyl, but it's like, looks like four grains of salt on a table, and that's like will kill a person. Hmm. So, so fentanyl test strips are a way to for people to test their drugs to find out whether it's heroin, fentanyl, or if there's and it's not just fentanyl. Fentanyl's not just going into heroin. Fentanyl is going into people's methamphetamine and everything else. Now, and so here's coming back to this question of like, what would I not have seen coming 5 years ago? 5 years ago, I probably would have said, well, that's really great. It's wonderful that the, you know, supply of heroin is not here, right? That's awesome. But what does that end up meaning for the life of somebody who is unfortunately wrapped up in that?
Yeah.
Now, it's challenging because I'm not willing to just say, like, that's all bad. The availability of
tension. There's some tension here.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. There just is. Like I get like how, like I would have responded to that differently 5 years ago. I see things that I wouldn't have seen. I see what it looks like for the guy or the gal who is now 8 years or 2 years or for that matter 6 months into a opiate addiction, and there's not a resource out there for them to even know what to do if they don't have the drug that they're used to, so they use fentanyl unknowingly or knowingly instead, and they die.
Yeah.
And I know some people are like, well, it's just, they should just die then. And I'm like, I don't, you go tell that to somebody's mom and dad. Come with me when you get to go tell somebody's mom or dad.
Yeah.
You know, you let's hang out together and you get to know people that are, you're now all of a sudden fine with saying they should just die, right? Instead, we have to deal with systemic problems. We have to deal then with day to day. What is this like for people who are going through this? I have a friend that just, somebody who's been, you know, in recovery, out of recovery, and he died just not quite a year ago, and he died, he relapsed, and he was intravenous user and shooting up in his back of his leg, ended up with an abscess, and so he didn't die of overdose. He died from an abscess on his leg infection that he did not want to go to the hospital to treat. So it's one of the other things. We work with a few different doctor's offices, and some of them come on our harm reduction mobile rig and do wound care to try and make sure that, because a lot of folks, like if they're struggling with illicit drug use, they don't trust the system, or they've been to the hospital too many times and the hospital doesn't want to see them. They just aren't going to go. They're just going to try and deal with it themselves. And so it's pretty tragic, the number of people that die of abscesses. I mean, he's super, Dale is his name. I hate to get like cost oriented on this, but we can operate our harm reduction program for about, I don't know, between staff and volunteer, staffing it and supplies and everything. It's right around $25,000-$30,000 a year, which is, well, my buddy Dale, his hospital bill that he still ended up dying was over $60,000,
mm-hmm.
just for one guy in the hospital for, I think he was there for a while, but even like some people are like, you know, do we really want to do that work? What all does it say? You know, and my goodness, isn't that expensive? It's like, no.
not, I mean, even for treatment. I mean, if, you know, how many times an individual has gone into treatment?
Oh, yeah.
Though, I mean, and that's part of similar
struggle. Devin, man, this has been incredible, our conversation with Cole. Crazy. Yeah.
We covered a lot of stuff, and it's been good.
It's been good, real good. And it's enough where, Devin, I think we need to go at this one more week.
Yeah, and we will. So thanks for being with us this week. We will be back with part 3 of Cole, where we dive into some more discipleship, some of the systemic things that are going on in our country and our community.
This podcast is produced by Ian Goodell, and if you would like to contact us, visit formjourney.com as well as Facebook and Instagram. We would love to hear your kingdom stories. And thanks for listening. God bless.